Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on America, B.C., when we come back. You know, once in a while we get a glimpse of the real world through the eyes of an insider like John Swinton, for instance. Swinton was the guest of honor at a banquet given to him by the leaders of his craft. Someone who knew neither the press nor John Swinton offered a toast to the independent press, and Swinton outraged his colleagues by replying that there's no such thing at this date of the world's history in America as an independent press. You know it, and I know it. And there's not one of you who dares to write your honest opinions, and if you did, you know beforehand that it would never appear in print. Now, I'm paid weekly for keeping my honest opinions out of the paper that I'm connected with, and others of you are paid similar salaries for similar things, and any of you who would be so foolish as to write your honest opinions would be out on the streets looking for another job. And if I allowed my honest opinions to appear in one issue of my paper, before 24 hours, my occupation would be gone. The business of the journalist is to destroy the truth, to lie outright, to pervert, to vilify, to fawn at the feet of mammon, and to sell his country and his race for his daily bread. Now you know it, and I know it. And what folly is this toasting of an independent press? We are the tools and vassals of rich men behind the scenes. We are the jumping jacks. They pull the strings and we dance. Our talents, our possibilities, and our lives are all the property of other men. We are intellectual prostitutes. Now, these rich men behind the scenes are the movers and shakers of the Global 2000 program and the New World Order. It's the men and families like the Windsors and Rockefellers and Bushes and Bundys and Carnegies and Vanderbilts. So let's wise up and start listening more to the God of Abraham and stop following after all these crazy scientists, philosophers, preachers, and politicians. And let's prepare to live through and survive this new world order and global 2000 insanity. Now, if you'd like to learn more about global 2000 and Bible prophecy and this new world order, why don't you call and order our free compact disc package. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative, best of all, it's free. And you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967 and order that free CD package. Now, that number again is 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and then send us an email request. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. The subject of America, B.C. sounds like an oxymoron. When we talk about B.C., that's the old term, you know, that said before Christ. And so when I went to school, we used to use B.C. and A.D., and they would take us back to B.C., that nebulous period of ancient history before Christ. Now, Christ came along about 2,000 years ago, so when we go back before 2,000 years, we're talking about going back some in time. Now, from Christ forward, we have a pretty good history, at least we think we do. We talk about the Roman Empire, and then we talk about the Middle Ages, and then we talk about the colonial period, and then we get up to the modern era. And we go to school and we learn about these historical facts. Remember, I can remember learning about Constantine and the founding of Christianity and the Roman Empire. And then knowledge fell off a cliff sometime after the Roman Empire collapsed in 476 AD and didn't recover until the Renaissance period of around 12 to 1700, about a 500-year period there from 1200 to about 700, called the Middle Ages, in which these great cathedrals and great knowledge in Isaac Newton and Galileo and Leonardo da Vinci and these great thinkers, you know, came along and revived knowledge, which somehow had been lost after the collapse of the Roman Empire. And then we enter the modern era. This is right after the colonial period. The Industrial Age, about 1800, took over in Europe, primarily in England, and has now ushered in space flight and jet aircraft and the modern technological era. What would you think if you had a technological era like we have today before Noah's flood? What would you think of that? Why, it sounds preposterous. Sounds insane. And yet I mentioned to you in the last program that Columbus, just 500 years ago, without any metallurgy at all, were casting iron to make cannon in sand, which is about as primitive as you can get. No blast furnaces, no modern technology, no turret lathes, no lathes at all, and no metal working at all. Now, there was some iron work, you know, taking raw iron or metals and copper and so on and beating them on a rock or beating them on an anvil to make a knife. Boys and girls, that's not metallurgy. Metallurgy is when you combine metals and you come up with steel. Now we're talking about metallurgy. Now we've done that in 500 years. The time frame between Adam and Eve and the flood was 1656 years. And in 1600 years, right at the very beginning, they were artificers in brass and iron. I brought that out to you last time. Now that has very important implications, especially when you combine that with another statement that's made over here in Genesis chapter 11, where God said at the Tower of Babel, when he came down, he took a look at the Tower of Babel, and he said, "Now look what they begin to do." And he said, "And now nothing will be restrained from them or withheld from them." Now that was quite a prophecy. This is the creator of the universe. He's taking a look now at men after the flood. At a place called the Tower of Babel, he said, verse 4, "Go to, let us build us a city and tower, whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Eternal came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Eternal said, Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they begin to do. And now, nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do." Quite a statement. Now take a look at where we are today. But it's a long time between the Tower of Babel, which occurred around 2300 BC, and today, 2007 as I speak, AD, we're talking about 4,000 plus years to get... to get to where we are today. Space flight. The other day they launched another flight up to the space station, and they're building a space station. They're talking now about going to Mars and going back to the moon and one thing and another. And we kind of take that as, you know, I see those reports by Katie Couric and Brian Williams like, oh, well, you know, there goes more of our tax dollars wasted on space exploration or whatever your view of it might be. But the point is, that prophecy has come to pass in our time. 90% of the scientists that have ever lived on Earth are alive today. 90%. Science and technology dominate. It permeates the entire world. It permeates our educational institutions, our politics, our economics. Everything around us is based upon science and technology, the computer. Now, when Barry Fell started looking at these monuments, these Ogham writings, He discovered that these were made not by the local Indians, not by the American Indians, but by somebody else. And of course the question arises, well, who was the somebody else? Where did these people come from? Now, this is where superstition came into the picture. Remember that the Catholic Church, which held sway over the minds of men during the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church had come up with some pronouncements that I'm sure that they all believed came from the Bible, and they all believed were true, accurate, and correct, which later we found were not. But nevertheless, they thought the world was flat, and they thought that the world, or the earth, was stationary in space, and the sun revolved around it, which is pretty logical, until some scientists came along, a guy by the name of Galileo, and said, no, it's not true, and let me tell you what the truth is. And not only was it totally rejected by the church fathers, they threatened to kill Galileo if he didn't recant. And we have the same superstition going on today in our educational institutions and our political establishments. If you don't adhere to the party line, and I mentioned this to you last time, the prestigious Smithsonian Institution, which is funded by your tax dollars and probably is the biggest collection or has the biggest collection of just about everything that there is in the world, said to their staff that if you can't adhere to our policies, then you need to resign. So much for freedom of speech or freedom of thought. Did it ever occur to us that maybe we don't have 100% of the truth today? And that maybe somebody else will come along 5, 10, 20, 30 years from now, and they will have clearer information, better facts, that's going to shed more light on a particular subject, and that maybe we're going to have to reevaluate our thinking in the future as it related to the past. Now, if you take a look at science textbooks of 100 years ago, they're so far out of date, and they're so filled with superstition and false doctrine and misguided facts that they're a laughing stock, absolute laughing stock. In fact, you won't even find science textbooks from the 1930s being used in your colleges and universities today. That's how recently that science had to be revised. Just the science of the 1920s and 30s and 40s had to be revised because it was false. But they don't come out and tell us, well, what we learned some 10, 20, 30 years ago is false. They never make that admission. They're kind of like President Bush. He never admits, I made a mistake or I'm wrong. We can all figure that out after the fact, but he never comes forward, and neither does science or technology come forward and say, hey, we were wrong about this, and so we're going to make this correction. And so let's delete this, and then for all of you people that believe this, let's take a little piece of history. In 1915, a ship called the Lusitania sailed from New York, and it was loaded with contraband from the United States, bound for Great Britain. Now, the Germans knew that this ship had contraband on it, and America, claiming to be neutral, said, no, we're not doing anything like that. We're not making arms, or we're not shipping arms and ammunition from the United States to Great Britain. So the Germans, through their intelligence apparatus, figured it out, and so they took out five ads in five big American newspapers and said, now listen, you Americans over there, butt out of our war over here in Europe, and if we catch this ship, they identified the ship, they said, if we catch this ship on the high seas, we're going to sink it. So don't get on it. It's dangerous. Americans didn't pay any attention, of course, because we believed our president, President Wilson at that time, would tell us the truth. Politicians lie to us constantly and continuously. Wilson was a liar. He said that we're not shipping any contraband, any war material to the British. He knew better. In fact, we found out later that this is now 1967, 50 years later. Not only were we shipping arms and munitions to the British on these merchant ships, we had a manufacturing plant in Indianapolis, Indiana, that was turning out war material, especially ammunition, for British caliber guns. So it wasn't that they were buying 30-06 ammunition and then buying 30-06 rifles and then shipping them over there. No, no. We had tooled up in this country, in our munitions factories, to turn out the munitions that would fit the British guns. Loaded it on British ships in New York, clandestinely, and then shipped it over to them. It's been going on now for a couple of years. So the British, in 1915, were hauling this stuff from the United States over to Great Britain. Makes all the sense in the world for them. And it makes all the sense in the world for the Germans to sink it. Now, my granddad believed President Wilson, and he instructed me, little Georgie Gordon, he said, those dirty Huns sank an unarmed merchant vessel. And that's one of the things that propelled America to get into the war on the British side. Now, the truth of the matter is, the Germans were correct. The British and the Americans were conspiring together to violate the law. We did. And we see that in Iraq and Afghanistan today. And after the fact, we can put those numbers together. And we can come to a conclusion. Our government lies to us from time to time. Now, has it ever occurred to us that our government and our colleges and our museums lie to us? At least from time to time. Now, I showed you last time, we were talking about the epilogue out of the book, which is called America B.C. And by the way, you can get a copy, I'm sure, of America B.C., written by Barry Fell. His name is F-E-L-L, that's easy enough, Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, America B.C., and it talks about the ancient settlers in the New World. In the epilogue, I brought you up to speed last time, and I showed you a couple of three examples of, for instance, the Ten Commandments written in Hebrew. This is called the famous Los Lunas inscription on Hidden Mountain, New Mexico, lower left, Fell, who reported in 1985 on the punctuation. Now, when did you ever hear in your high school class about ancient history, about the Ten Commandments being found down near Albuquerque, New Mexico? I never did. I went to public school. Now, here's another example. Ogham inscriptions occur on prostrate monoliths in New England and in Quebec. This example, shown in the lower picture, is at Blanchard near Cavendish, Vermont. Warren Dexter, who stands behind, has given much attention to these and has also visited corresponding sites in Ireland. The lack of vowels and occasional severe weathering make the decipherment difficult and uncertain. The weathered aspect and the patina imply considerable antiquity, perhaps comparable with the, here's a strange word here, E-P-I-M-E-G-A-L-I-T-H-I-C, I guess that's Epimigalithic of Ireland, about 1200 B.C. onward, when Gaelic-speaking people occupied Ireland. And according to the interpretation of Professor R.A.S. McAllister, this small stone on its two surfaces carries a pagan invocation for protection against sickness and the evil eye, and David P. Barron reported it from Connecticut in the ESOP, Volume 16, back in 1987. Here's another example. Hebrew inscription at Bat Creek, Tennessee, now dated by radiocarbon to the Middle Woodland period, about 1605 B.C. Here's yet another example. Roman amphora. These are Roman vases of the 3rd century A.D. brought up from the seabed at Guanabara Bay, Brazil. Now, what in the world are these ancient Roman vases doing over in Brazil from the 3rd century? Now, you know, you don't have to be real smart to figure out that. Let's see. If we were to find Roman vases submerged in a bay in Brazil that date back to the 3rd century, well, then wouldn't it tell you that Romans must have visited there in the 3rd century? I mean, you know, just all things being equal. Here's another example. Coins. Roman coins believed to have been washed ashore from a vessel thought to have sunk around 375 A.D. off the coast of Beverly, Massachusetts. Beverly, Massachusetts. 375 A.D. off the coast of Beverly, Massachusetts. These Romans are traveling from Brazil to Massachusetts in the 3rd century. This is the period of Constantine. Do you remember when you went to catechism and they told you about Constantine, the great Christian, who changed the Sabbath, you know, from Saturday to Sunday? Yeah, that's about the period of time during the Roman Empire. And here we find shipwrecks and Roman coins in America from Brazil to Massachusetts. And there's more. Here's another one. Ogham writing all over the United States. Some 3,000 sites of this Ogham writing, which is a form of writing that comes from the British Isles and is found up and down the Mississippi River, up and down the Arkansas, Cimarron rivers, all the way over to Denver, Colorado. From Denver, Colorado to New Orleans, there are sites everywhere where this Ogham writing appears. Here's another one. Opposite the Viking Church Tower at Newport, Rhode Island. Now, you people here, this is quite a little thing. This has got an iron fence around it. It's in Newport, Rhode Island. It's a Viking Church Tower at Newport, Rhode Island, and although observed and mapped by the Italian navigator Giovanni Verrazzano in 1524, modern tradition mistakenly attributes it to Governor Benedict Arnold. Below, a portion of the inscription in Norse runes on the so-called Kensington Stone of Minnesota. It reports the misadventures of a party of Norse explorers in the year 1362. Recent studies by Dr. Richard Nielsen completely vindicate the authenticity of this historic document and dispel charges of fraud raised by earlier writers. Now, that's just the tip of the iceberg from the epilogue of the book America, B.C. All right, now if I've got your interest, let's take a look here at chapter 16, the New England Celtic place names. On page 247, New England's place names. By early October, the fall was well advanced in the Green Mountains, and the opening of the hunting season meant that it would no longer be safe to venture far from the beaten tracks, since any movement that we might make in the underbrush would be likely to attract a rifle shot. I also had writing commitments to attend to, so John and I agreed to separate our efforts for the time being, he to roam the backcountry roads to check on promising areas that we had been considering for some time, and myself to pound the typewriter. However, we were pleased to receive a most cordial invitation from Professor Warren L. Cook of the Department of History and Anthropology at Castleton State College, inviting John, Peter, and me to meet with his students for lectures and seminars on our finds. Several of his students had, in fact, called me or telephoned to offer their assistance as voluntary field parties or in any other capacity in their power. Nothing could be more appropriate than to give the first college lectures on our work at Castleton in the heart of the Celtic country one beautiful fall day. Therefore, we made the trip. Our audience was enthusiastic and well prepared, asking many of the opposite questions and holding us until late in the afternoon. Jim Whittall and Bob Stone came also, and some of the local landowners were there. Now, this chapter covers the material included in one of the Castleton meetings where I pointed out to my audience that they already knew many Celtic words. When, as a stranger to the land, I first began some 12 years earlier to travel the country roads of New England, I was frequently amazed and amused by the extraordinary barbarity of such Amerindian place names. Amerindian place names, as had somehow survived the onslaught of the colonists who renamed almost every part they settled after some British hometown. Words such as Umbagog or Skuunk conjured images of Neanderthal uncouthness, totally out of kilter with my own Polynesian background of euphonious words, often with a romantic connotation. What exiled Umbagonian could shed tears for Umbagog? But I was mistaken. Modern Gaelic, preserving as it does many spelled letters that are no longer pronounced, looks considerably different if converted to a phonetic manner of writing. If further one allows for the ancient spelling or pronunciation of Gaulish, the ancestral tongue of the Celts, then many New England names assume a new aspect despite the quaint manner of transliteration used by the colonists in the days before Webster introduced a standard form of matching spelling to the spoken sound. Now take the name of the Amoskeag River, spelled A-M-O-S-K-E-A-G River, for example, where important archaeological remains exist. When I first visited this site, the name meant nothing to me, and I assumed it to be an Algonquin Indian name, but never thought to inquire if the name had a meaning. Well, indeed, the word does have a meaning. As J. Almus Rustle has pointed out in an article in 1972, recently brought to my attention by my friend Gertrude Johnson. Now, according to Russell, the competent scholarship shows that the Algonquin sense of the word Amoskeag is one who takes small fish. Now, no sooner had I seen this translation than I immediately recognized the word as a Celtic Amoskeag, spelled A-M-M-O hyphen I-A-S-G-A-G. Now, for you listeners out there, you'll have to take a look at the spelling of the words in the book to appreciate the similarities here. But it means small fish stream. So, let me just pause here for a moment and point out to you that here are the Algonquin Indians using a name, a place name, on a stream up in New England. Barry Fell comes along, and he hears this strange name. You know, I'm from the West, and many of the names of streams and counties and place names are Indian names, like the Hoopaw Indians from Hoopaw. Well, who came up with the name Hoopaw? Well, the Indians came up with the name Hoopaw. Now, the distinction here is that when this name came up, he simply thought, well, it's an Indian name, so what's the big deal? Now he asks the question, well, what does this Indian name have some meaning? And it means small fish stream. He now takes a look at the spelling of the Gaelic or the Celtic word, which means small fish stream. The Gaelic word for fish is I-A-S-G, and the suffix A-G is the sign of the diminutive, giving the sense small fish, and evidently the main purport of the name was imparted to the Algonquin Indians by the Celts. But some details of the sense, as well as the precise pronunciation, have been blurred by the passage of time. Now, alerted by this surprising coincidence of meaning and sound, I began to look at New England place names with a new and more critical eye, as often as not perceiving familiar Celtic words and phrases where formerly I hadn't noticed them. There was a time not so long ago when my heart leaped whenever John Williams took me across the border into Vermont, and I sensed that the Celts were all about me. But now I perceive their unseen presence all along the Merrimack Valley and the geographical names of New Hampshire and other parts of New England are strung like a rosary whose beads tell of times long past. The Celtic presence is all-embracing and by no means confined within the borders of the Green Mountain State. Let me give you just a short list by way of examples. He says, look at the river names first, and then since we have already cited the Amoskeag, bear in mind also that in Britain, nearly all of the river names are Celtic, even though now flowing through regions where Saxons have usurped the land these past 1,500 years. Here, as also, Their Celtic names have a strangely enduring quality, and rivers, it would seem, tend to keep their old names despite the invasions of foreign conquerors over hundreds and even thousands of years of time. So you people up there in New England are sitting on one of the richest sources of archaeological finds of settlers and explorers who have come to the Americas over the last 3,000 years. We are simply the last group that have found America. America has been found and lost numerous times by ancient peoples. Now, this is a fascinating question. Why was it lost? If they found it in the age of Solomon, let's say, well, then what happened that cut off the old world from the new world? Did something dramatic occur? Well, you bet it did, and it's revealed in the pages of the Bible. It was the destruction of the Celtic people in the Middle East. When God destroyed Israel in 718 BC, the people over here in the Western world got cut off from the Eastern world, and they were cut off for thousands of years. Well, maybe not thousands, but at least for hundreds of years, and then they were refound in the Carthaginian period. And then they were lost again during the Roman period, and then the Romans and the Egyptians came over and refound it. And the reason that we have pyramids here in the New World that look just like the pyramids of Egypt is because the Egyptians were here. And the reason that we have these place names up in New England is because the Celts were here. Now, isn't that just real special? Well, hang on here, kids, and let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet daily. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour editorial review is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, now the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, or they may be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing the book American BC, that's A-M-E-R-I-C-A, America BC by Dr. Barry Fell. Fell was a professor up at Harvard University. He's written a number of books and founded an organization called the Epigraphic Society. This Epigraphic Society, I called them one time, and they're an underground paper. They're not mainstream, so if you're looking for mainstream information, you don't want to go to them. Let me see if I got their number here in my card catalog. I do. It's called the Epigraphic Society, so for some of you hardcore guys out there, the phone number is 978-774-1275. Once more, that's 978-774-1275. Now, there's a fellow by the name of Donald, D-O-N-A-L. Now, that's not Donald, it's D-O-N-A-L. Odd name, Buchanan is his last name. And he lives at 97 Village Post Road in Danvers, Massachusetts. And the zip code there is 01923. Now, that's called the Epigraphic Society, an underground archaeological publication. If you want to find the truth about something, almost inevitably you're going to have to go somewhere else. For instance, if you wanted to know the truth about the round earth and whether or not the earth was circling the sun, you'd have to go to Galileo. And for hundreds of years afterwards, you'd have to go to the underground press to find out anything about it. You wouldn't find it in the mainstream Catholic-approved newspapers or magazines or television commercials of the day. I mean, that's just where reality is at. Nothing's changed. Nothing's changed, boys and girls. If you want the truth about anything, you're going to have to dig it out. That's why the scripture says the whole world has been deceived. See that over here in Revelation 12, verse 9. The whole world has been deceived. So if you come to the conclusion that you might have been one of them, well, then it's incumbent upon all of us then to find out, well, what is this deception, and let's see if we can't correct it. And the Epigraphic Society with Donald Buchanan, 97 Village Post Road, Danvers, D-O-N-V-E-R-S, Massachusetts, zip code 01923, is one of the places to go. Not the only, but one of. Now, if you'd like to get started, then let me recommend the book, America BC. Fell has written a number of other books. I'm not reviewing them, so I'm not going to get into it, but this one is a dynamite book. And this guy was hated. Now, I talked to one of his sidekicks, a lady by the name of Gloria Farley. She just died recently. She was an old lady, pushing 90. And she'd been running up and down the rivers, running up and down the landscape in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Colorado, digging out these old Celtic, Ogham, Irish writings and inscriptions. And she wrote a book called In Plain Sight. One of these days we'll review her book. But she was a sidekick here of Barry Fell. And in talking to her, she said, "You will not believe the opposition that we have received for our work. We are hated and despised, we're vilified, we're lied about, misquoted, and misrepresented continuously by the academic community here in America." Now, the thing that gave the concept of ancient explorers coming to America some credibility was this Harvard professor, Barry Fell. Pretty hard. You know, Gloria Farley, now she's just a lay person. So when you're a lay person and you don't have letters after your name, if you come along like Galileo, I suspect he didn't have many letters after his name like the Pope, and he said, "Hey, let me tell you what I see, what I've heard, what I know," then the lettered people come along. kind of like the Bible says, who is this Jesus having no letters? They actually questioned it. Hey, this guy can't know anything. He hasn't been to college. He hasn't been to seminary. Same thing is true today. Hell, if you haven't been to seminary, you can't know anything. I always think about Henry Ford, you know, the guy that made, I don't know if he made billions, but he made many millions of dollars. I know in 1930, he was severely criticized for making $30 million in 1931. 1931, Henry Ford made $30 million, and Franklin D. Roosevelt pointed to that. And he said, here's America's number one industrialist, making $30 million while you people are selling apples on the street corners, trying to get enough to eat. I guess old Ford could have said, like Babe Ruth, well, I had a better year than the average guy selling apples on the street corners. But nevertheless, Henry Ford, with all of his millions, only went to the sixth grade. He had a sixth grade education. There's another one out here, a guy by the name of Bill Gates. He was going to college. He dropped out of college and then went to work and made $37 billion in the process. I just wanted to point out to you that not everybody goes to college. Not everybody has a degree after their name. And not everybody that doesn't have a degree is dumb. There's a couple of guys out there with no degrees that know something. So I just wanted to point out that when Barry Fell came along, everybody listens to the guy because, wait a minute, he's a Harvard professor with a degree after his name. And Fell went about it, he went about it very softly. Very softly. As I'm reading his book over here, I noticed that he's not out here throwing down the gauntlet and saying, all right, suckers, this is where it's at, like it or lump it. Which I suppose is kind of like President Bush, you know, when he said, bring them on. Got a little cocky there, you know, bring them on. Fell was not a bring them on type of guy. All right, let me suggest to you that we take a look here at the Egyptian presence on page 253. The Egyptians here in the New World. This chapter sets out newly recognized evidence showing clearly that ancient Egyptians once visited North America, and while here, they imparted a detailed knowledge of their complicated hieroglyphic writing to the people who lived in Canada and the United States at that time. The evidence is extraordinarily rich in variety and amount, and perhaps one of the more surprising things is that no one until now seems to have noticed it. Pause. Let me put my famous mark in the margin. I went down to Mexico City when I was a kid back in 1958-960, along in there, made two or three trips, and I went out to the Pyramid of the Sun. And when I got out there and I looked at that mountain, I mean, it's a mountain of cut rock. Now, I haven't been to Egypt, and I haven't seen the Great Pyramid eyeball to eyeball, but I've seen the pictures of it. And I'm telling you, kids, that pyramid down there in Mexico City looks just like that pyramid or those three pyramids out there in Egypt. Just take a look at the pictures. And I remember as a kid, I was probably 19, 20, 21 years old, and I looked at that and I said, wait a minute. How in the hell can you build a pyramid like that one right there I'm looking at in Mexico City unless you had seen one of those once before? Now, I told you about these pyramids. There's about 7, 8, 9 of them. I forgot not exactly what the number is. Over here in Illinois. Now, they're not made out of cut rock. They're made out of dirt. Now, I don't know how many people it takes to build a mountain. Now, these mountains, these pyramids, they cover many acres of ground. The base of these pyramids, the Great Pyramid of Egypt, which is the biggest, covers 14 acres. 14 acres at the base. And then, of course, it tapers up to the top. And on top of the Pyramid of the Sun, there's a flat spot up there, and I'm going to tell you, it was pretty good size. I was impressed. It was probably 10 feet by 10 feet, I'm going to guess. You know, maybe it's 6 by 6 or 8 by 8 or 10 by 10, but it's a pretty good size flat spot up there. and the guide. And when you climb to the top of it, let me tell you, it's about a 3-foot step each time you step up this thing. And it takes a lot of work. When you're a kid, 19, you can do it. But, you know, as an old man today, I'm not so sure I'd want to climb to the top of those pyramids. But when I got up there, the guide who'd followed me up, he said, the Spanish explorers took it off of here, but there was a solid sheet of gold up here. That's why they called it the Pyramid of the Sun. A solid sheet of gold on top of this pyramid. Now, I don't know how thick it was. I mean, that's really the telling tale. But I'm just telling you, kids, if that sheet of gold that was up on top of that pyramid was an eighth of an inch thick, that was a whale of a lot of gold up there. Whale of a lot of gold. And that's why they called it the Pyramid of the Sun, because the sun would come up and it would reflect off of that gold up there at the top of it. And then he said they made human sacrifices up there, so evidently it was some kind of a religious monument. And they had to have an idea that they were copying that from. So when I read Fell's book, and Fell corroborated for me, my gut reaction was, my common sense said to me, these people have had contact with the Egyptians. Fell comes along, writes a book, and he says, yep, that's right, the Egyptians were here in the New World. Now, I don't know whether the Egyptians built that pyramid down there, or whether the Indians built it, or like Columbus. Now, Columbus took a bunch of Indians from America back to Europe. Did those Indians that he took to Europe come back to the New World? I suppose they did. Or some of them did. And when they did they bring back any European customs or ideas with them? And vice versa. I mean, there's a lot of things that Columbus learned over here in the New World and then took back to the Old World, you know, like corn and tobacco. Now, my opportunity, this is Barry Fell, and I says, my opportunity to study it came about mainly through sleuthing by John Williams. After the ground froze in New England, John began a lengthy search of the documents stored in the great Widener Library of Harvard College. And he was seeking out references in earlier reports of excavations that might lead us to find new sites to explore, or to museums where material of significance to our studies might be stored. In the course of this inquiry, he consulted works in the Indian languages. One day, John brought me a copy of a curious document printed in New York in 1866, and it included in a book on the Wabanaki Indians of Maine, written by Eugene Vitromile, a priest who ministered to those Indians. This document comprised a single sheet. It was headed the Lord's Prayer in Makmik hieroglyphics. At first glance, I perceived that about half, at least, of the hieroglyphic signs were remarkably similar to Egyptian hieroglyphics, as rendered in the simple cursive form called hieratic, spelled H-I-E-R-A-T-I-C. But what was more surprising to me, indeed mystifying, was that the meanings of these signs in Egyptian matched the meaning assigned to them in the English translation of the Mi'kmaq text which was given on the document. Now, let me put my famous mark here. Think about this. Here's a piece of paper that is written in 1866 by a missionary. This missionary is up here talking to the Mi'kmaq Indians in Maine, 1866. And he translates the Lord's Prayer out of English into the Mi'kmaq language. And in the Mi'kmaq language, he uses their signs. I'm sure this guy must have known that these were Egyptian hieroglyphics. But he may not have. Maybe he didn't. But he knew the Mi'kmaq language. He'd been among them. He'd been ministering to them. And he knew what their hieroglyphic signs were, say for a fish, or for a dog, or for a turtle, or something else. And so he translates the Lord's Prayer out of English for the Mi'kmaq into these Egyptian hieroglyphics. Now, my gut reaction says, well, he probably knew Egyptian hieroglyphics. And that's probably why he put a copy of it into a museum. He saved a copy of it, or if he didn't, somebody else did. Now, here it is in the Harvard. It's buried in the Harvard Library. And this professor comes along. He discovers what he sees as Egyptian hieroglyphics in Maine among the Mi'kmaq Indians. Now, hey, kids, wait a minute. Hang on a second. One of two things here. Either one, the Mi'kmaqs independently, accidentally, just by caprice, just happened to use the same symbols to describe fish, turtles, dogs, etc., as the Egyptians. Or else, the Mi'kmaqs must have gone to Egypt and picked it up, or the Egyptians came to Maine and left it behind. Now, what do you think? Now, just being a farm kid and all, if I read a story like this, I say, oh, okay. Kind of like when I was a kid, I'm down here looking at this big pyramid, and I said, wow. I mean, you've got to actually stand down there at the bottom of it and look at it to say, wow. When you see a picture, it does not convey to your mind the immensity, the complexity of that pyramid. The work, the labor, the engineering that went into that. And the same thing is true with these dirt pyramids up here in Illinois. They're nothing to sneeze at. They are monsters. They are huge. You've got to actually look at that thing, stand at the bottom of it to appreciate it. Now, it may be made out of dirt, but how many basketfuls of dirt did those Indians carry from someplace out there and pile it up? Where did the dirt come from? It's not excavated anywhere close by. Or if it was, it's all been filled in again. I mean, we're talking about mountains. We're talking about 10 or 15 acres of land at the base, 400 feet high with 1/2 acre on the top of it. Now, that's the size of the pyramid that I walked up to in Illinois. I walked up to the top of it. Now, when you see something like this and you muse, you say, wow, these Indians, they weren't as dumb as we give them credit for. You know, we Americans today aren't building pyramids like that. We're flying to the moon or we're flying out into space, but we're not building pyramids. Now, these people had technology. These people had an ability. And they tell us. Now, when I went to school, when we were talking about the Great Pyramid, they told us that in order to level that thing up, and it's perfectly level, the Great Pyramid is perfectly level, sitting on bedrock. And I was told in the 10th grade that in order to do that, they sewed goat intestines together to make a water level, which is common. You can take a hose, fill it with water. And you know, 50, 100 feet, and you can level from 50 to 100 feet through that hose with a water level. I don't deny that. I don't deny it. But I've never seen anybody do that over 14 acres, which is nearly a quarter of a mile. And that's the way they said that they leveled up the Great Pyramid. Leveled it up. And then they squared it up. Squared it up. And in 1964, there was some outfit, I don't know if it was Bechtel or somebody, went over there with a laser transit and measured that thing up, and it's plus or minus 1/2 inch over 14 acres, which is a quarter of a mile from one corner to the next. And they did it with a laser transit, and it wasn't until 1964 that they were able to measure the accuracy of that building, which, by the way, has expansion and contraction grooves cut into the base so that when the sun heats it, and typically on one side, it heats it on one side, it will expand through those expansion grooves so that it doesn't break the stone. Now, you're going to tell me that these people built that with goat guts? You know, I'm an old-timey general contractor, kids. I'm living in a house 40 by 50 feet, 40 feet long, or 50 feet long, 40 feet wide. I put a roof on it here some years back. And naturally, in the process of putting the roof on, this house, which is very, very well built, is 2 inches out of square, and it's 40 by 50. And this great pyramid now is plus or minus a half an inch. Plus or minus a half inch. My house is plus or minus 2 inches. Actually, it's plus or minus 1 inch on two corners, which equals 2 inches out of square. But, you know, when we put the roof on it, it's longer at the top by an inch and longer at the bottom on the opposite end by an inch. It's not exactly square. And it's only 40 by 50 feet, and it's accepted, you know, construction. I don't think anybody'd complain about this house being out by an inch. But it's not covering 14 acres. It's not a quarter of a mile from corner to corner. And it's not accurate to within a half an inch. Now, I don't know about the Pyramid of the Sun down in Mexico City. I haven't seen any numbers on that. But boys and girls, here's the bottom line. These ancient people were not dumb. And they weren't dragging their knuckles on the ground like we've been taught in our public schools about how man is getting smarter and smarter and evolving and developing. Boys and girls, we had technology and we lost it. And we're just now getting it back. I would venture a guess and say that technology today still has not reached the level of technology prior to Noah's flood. We're not there yet. And now the Egyptian presence here in the New World puts an entirely new wrinkle. It wasn't just the Celts, but the Romans were also here. We have evidence now of the Egyptians being over here. In the same way that the Japanese are in Europe. Japanese ships travel to Europe. Japanese ships travel to South America. Japanese ships travel to Canada. Japanese ships travel to America. Japanese ships, boys and girls, travel to every country in the world. American ships travel to every country in the world. German ships travel to every country in the world. There was worldwide commerce in the days of Solomon. Now there's more to be shed on that story by Stephen Collins, who wrote 5 books. The Lost 10 Tribes of Israel Found was his first book. Quite a story. I'll tell you more about Collins, and we'll pick this up next time on the Egyptian presence in the United States of America, B.C., next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Meanwhile, let me remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, our time's about up. We're going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.